Job chapter 27 is where we will spend our time in God's Word today. As we have worked our way together through the book of Job, we know enough about his story, even if we haven't been here every Sunday as we've gone verse by verse through it together. We know enough about his story to know how difficult his life has become. Life was not always that way for Job. He had things good. He had things really good. But now he's really struggling. He has relationship problems. He has marital problems. He has physical problems. He's struggling spiritually. He's struggling emotionally. He's struggling mentally. And through all of that, we've pointed out, as we've kind of come across it, that there are a couple of things that Job is clinging to through everything that he's going through. One of them is hope. Even though his hope is kind of cloudy, if you will, now compared to it once was, he is still holding on to his hope in God. Even when he wonders what God is up to, he still is holding on to his hope in God. We might even get to see that again this morning. And then the other thing that Job is holding on to is his integrity. And that's really what launches us here into Job chapter 27. Because as Job responds to his friends, we're going to see him pretty quickly in these first few verses mention his integrity once again. Look with me, if you would, at Job 27, verse 1. It says, "Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, 'As God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live.'" Job here is responding to his friends who have constantly and consistently proven themselves to be not very good friends. Not bringing comfort to a man who was looking for comfort. A man who, when he saw them coming from a distance, actually said to himself, "They are coming to comfort me." And that was their goal. They're just really, really bad at it. His friends are consistent in insisting, "Job, you are a sinner, and there is some specific sin that you have done that has caused all of the bad to happen in your life." But that is where Job holds on to his integrity. Listen, he would agree that he is a sinner. Who isn't a sinner? But he would also say, "There is nothing that I have done that has brought these catastrophic things into my life." Now listen, you and I know that's the case. You and I have Job chapter 1 and an interaction in heaven between God and Satan. You and I have Job chapter 2 and a second interaction in heaven between God and Satan. We know those things. We know Job is right. What's going on in his life is not the result of sin. Not everything bad that happens in our lives is a result of our own sin or the result of someone else's sin. Sometimes it's simply a testing or a trial that the Lord is allowing. Job doesn't know that. We have more insight into his life than Job has into his own life. What he does know and what he expresses in verses 2, especially in verse 2, I should say, is that he believes that God is behind what's happening to him. You see how he phrases it there in verse 2, "As God lives." He says, "God has taken away my justice," and he says that the Almighty has made his soul bitter. Yet he doesn't walk away from the Lord. He doesn't pull back from the Lord. He continues where he is. He continues with this desire to really press into the Lord, even though he doesn't understand or agree with what God is up to. And you know what? That's so important for us, because we live in a world today where if something isn't working right, we just abandon it. We just toss it aside and replace it with something else if it's not working the way it's supposed to work. We have several things in our house that stopped working, and when they stopped working, we just replaced them with another one, but we kept the old one in case we ever needed it for parts. because we are so good at taking apart things and replacing things. No, we're not really. So we really don't need all of those different things. And some of us, we just throw out the old, even if we could save it for parts. But sometimes we do that with relationships. Well, this friendship isn't quite going the way that I thought it would go, and so we just toss it aside. Sometimes we even attribute that to God. God's not doing quite what I thought he would be doing. And so rather than pressing on with him, I'm going to pull back from him and ultimately set him aside. And Job would not do that. If anyone was pulling back from God, it was actually Job's friends, even as they insisted otherwise in their own lives. They came across as the spiritual know-it-alls and the superior Christians, but they were anything but that. In fact, look at Job's insistence here in verse 4. As he speaks to his friends, he says, "My lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right." See, that would have been the quick way for Job to get his friends to stop talking. It would have been just for him to agree with them. Just for him to say to his friends, okay, guys, I've had enough, you're right. Even if he knew in his heart and in his mind that that would be a lie, it was just a little lie. And it gave Job some peace and quiet. But he says, you know what? I am so holding on to my integrity that I am not even willing to tell a little lie, even if it would immediately benefit me in getting you guys to be quiet. My tongue, he says there in verse 4, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. I'm not going to agree that you're right when I know you're not right, just to get you to be quiet, or just to get this part of, you know, our conversation over with, or whatever the case may be. Now, for Job, everything was black and white when it came to his relationship with God. Everything was black and white when he looked at the world around him. Everything fell into one of two categories. He actually mentions them here for us. The first one is in verse 4. He mentions wickedness. And then at the beginning of verse 6, he mentions righteousness. Wickedness and righteousness. They're opposite from each other. They're synonyms for both of them, some even here in this chapter. But wickedness and righteousness are on the two opposite ends of the spectrum. And for Job, everything was either falling into that category of being something wicked or being something righteous. There was no gray area. There was no, well, you know, that person is kind of wicked, but they're a little bit righteous, or that person is kind of righteous, but they have that one bad streak that they do. No, it was that clear for Job. There's wickedness and there's righteousness. And I'm pretty sure he didn't come up with that on his own. I'm pretty sure that as he got to know the Lord and walked with the Lord, he understood that for God, things are that black and white. For God, things are that crystal clear. For God, everything falls into the area of wickedness or the area of righteousness. No one is going to be able to stand before God and say, God, you know what? I know I did some wicked things, but I did more righteous things. Please let me in. That's not the way that it works. Or the person who says, well, God, I'm righteous in all of these different ways. And yeah, there's that one wicked thing that I used to do, but I'm mostly righteous. No. It's that clear from God's perspective, and that's been imprinted, if you will, in Job's life. Everything falls into one of those two categories. You're either wicked or you're righteous. And for Job, he was not going to do anything, even just a little lie, because that would be considered wickedness. I think, well, first of all, we can easily say, right, an easy application point here is don't lie, right? Yes? Okay, good. Good, right. I mean, that's simple, right? We know it. It's one of the Ten Commandments and all of these different things. Proverbs says that there are seven things that God despises. Leading that list is a proudful look, but on that list is a lying tongue. God doesn't like lying. God is about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, right? I mean, we even hear that in the court system still to this day. And that's what God is about. God is about the truth because God is the truth. God's word is truth, but also, of course, we have Jesus who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. There's all kinds of connections we can make there. But please understand, it begins with the little lie. It begins with a little lie. And all of us at some point, if not you, that's fine, you can tell me later, but I'm pretty sure all of us at some point have told the little lie for some of the same reasons that Job was considering telling it. I'm just going to tell this person I agree with him just to get them to shut up. So tired of hearing it. Or, you know what, it's just a little thing. It's just a little exaggeration. It's just a little lie. It doesn't change anything in the grand scheme of things. But in actuality, it does. And that's what Job brings up next. And it tells us why he is so insistent on not even letting the little lie shoot out of his mouth. Verse 7, he says this.
May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he may gain much, if God takes away his life?
Now, the flow keeps going from there, but we're going to stop for a second, because Job just gave us a couple of other words that are synonymous with wicked or wickedness, and one of those two words is Job's actual concern of where lying lips can lead. So look with me at what we just read again. You see in verse 7, once again, the mention of wicked. But then at the end of verse 7, we have a synonym to the word wicked, which is the word unrighteous. That's pretty easy to figure out, because we're talking about righteous. The opposite of righteous is unrighteous. But then he gives us another word that is also a synonym for being wicked. It's in verse 8, for what is the hope of the hypocrite? So for Job, wicked, unrighteous, hypocrite are all the same thing. But by using the word hypocrite, he's also cluing us into his thought process of why not just tell the little lie? Why? What does it really matter? Why not lie? I wish the kids were back in here now. Why not lie about how much homework you got done?
Or, you know, every summer now at near the last day of school, oh, there's a summer reading packet that the kids have to bring home, right? Or a summer math packet. I don't even understand half the math that's on there. And there you go. And, oh, have you done it? Yeah. Well, how much have you done? I did a page. It's just a little lie. Like I know that they're thinking, what could that possibly harm?
And Job, in using that word hypocrite, is cluing us into something.
A hypocrite isn't somebody who lies with their lips. A hypocrite is somebody who lies by the way they live their life. That they say one thing, but they do another. And a lot of times what they say isn't a lie, because then they'd be living the truth. It's the other way around. What they're saying is the truth, but what they're living is a lie. That was Jesus' problem with the hypocrites. The Pharisees, he were very often called that by Jesus when he walked this earth. And so the problem with the little lie is that it doesn't stay just one, and it doesn't stay little.
If you've ever had a problem with lying, maybe you found yourself getting to the point where you begin losing track of who you told what to. You begin losing track of the lie. You told this lie to this person. Now, sometimes you even have to tell another lie to cover up that first lie, and then somebody else says something and you tell them a slightly different version, a lie, but then you kind of lose track of which version you told to which person, and all of a sudden now it's like a spider web. Right? It's just kind of gone like this. It's like if you get a crack in your windshield sometimes. And then you get those, I don't know what they're called. Looks like a spider web though, right? Across your windshield as it grows. Well, that's what a little lie can do. Either it grows by itself, or now you begin developing this kind of thing where you don't have a problem telling a lie. It just becomes easier for you and more natural for you. And Job says, if I go start down that road, where that road leads is to hypocrisy. Where that road leads isn't just to lies coming across my lips. It's a lie the way that I live my life. And that was his concern. And he tells us a few things here that are issues for those who are living or speaking one way and living another, for those who are playing that role of hypocrite. You see the first one there in verse 8, what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he may gain much if God takes away his life? What is the hope of the hypocrite? Job's point is this: the hypocrite has no hope when he stands before God. The person who has been saying one thing and doing another has no hope when they stand before God. That's one of the long-term problems for the hypocrite, Job says. If you're going to live a lie, ultimately, there's no hope for you. Even if, you see how he phrases it there? Even if, in verse 8, he gains much, what happens when God takes away his life? Hey, lying in our world today may get you somewhere. It may get you friends, at least temporarily. It may get you the job that you want. It may get you more money in your bank account. It may get you a lot of things. But as the Bible says, sin has a way of being pleasurable, but just for the moment. Lying may gain you much now, but when it comes to what your soul needs, it gains you nothing. You've probably heard before that verse from Mark chapter 8. What does it matter if a man gains the whole world but loses his soul? It's a question that Jesus asked in Mark chapter. Actually, you know what? Let's turn there for a minute, because there's a second question that he immediately follows that up with. Mark chapter 8. We'll come back to Job 27. This is Mark chapter 8, verse 36, so it's near the end of the chapter. Verse 36 is the probably more, popular question, or the one we've heard before more. In Mark chapter 8, verse 36, he says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?" When Job talked about hope, he wasn't talking about hope in the here and now. He was talking about hope in the hereafter. And a person who decides that they have no problem living the life of the hypocrite may gain much from the world, but it will be at the cost of his soul. But what's interesting to me in Mark chapter 8, verse 37, is that Jesus follows his question up, not with an answer, but actually with another question. So in Mark chapter 8, verse 36, the one where I think we're more familiar with, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?" He immediately follows it up with, "Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" It's almost like, and Paul does this sometimes too, where Paul in his writings in the Bible, he has this knack, God-given certainly, Spirit-led, for being able to, presuppose what somebody might ask in response to something he said. So Paul will just deal with it before they even ask him the question. And I kind of feel like that's what Jesus is doing. That there are people who hear, "For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul?" who would answer that question by saying, "Well, I'll just trade some stuff for my soul. Just tell me how much my soul costs. Tell me how much I have to give, and I'll make sure that I have that amount of money in my bank account, or I'll make sure that I have that much money, that much in good works in my life, so that when I stand before God, I can gain the whole world, but I won't lose my soul. Just tell me the price I have to pay." And so Jesus asks that second question: what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Because he knows that's the way some people think. Some people think, "Just tell me the amount." You know, people like that, and that's kind of sometimes how they deal with things on earth too. Like, okay, I know that just happened. Tell me how much. Tell me what you need for it to go away. Tell me how much you need for it to be fixed, and so on and so forth. And that's how they're going to look at the cost of their soul. So when Jesus says, "What will a man give in exchange for his soul?" the idea there is, there's no amount. There's no amount of money that you and I could come up with that equals the value of our soul to God.
That there's no amount of good works that we can string together on planet Earth, even if all we do falls in the category of righteousness, and none of what we do follows in the category of wickedness. All of our good works combined do not come close to the value that God has placed on our soul.
So back to Job chapter 37. We now understand why Job is saying that the person who lives the life of the wicked, unrighteous hypocrite, saying one thing but living another, praising the Lord on Sunday mornings. I can't remember where it is in the New Testament. Either James, Peter, John, or Paul wrote it, you know, one of the four New Testament Beatles. And what they said is, out of your mouth comes blessings and curses. My brothers, this should not be so. It's James. All right, thank you. Our ladies just studied it on Tuesdays this past year. Out of the same mouth come blessings and curses. My brethren, it should not be so. Praising God on a Sunday morning, oh, you know, Jesus is better. Cursing in traffic on the way to work on Monday mornings. Or not even waiting till Monday, just having it out with one of your kids or your spouse on Sunday night and that kind of a thing. That's not something that God says we should be doing. That's being hypocritical. So part of the problem, Job says in chapter 27, verse 8, is what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he may gain much, if God takes away his life? And then in verses 9 and 10, we definitely see that there is a disconnect between the wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical person and God. He says in verse 9, will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God? And that's the problem with the hypocrite, isn't it? That when things get tough, they call out to God. When they have a problem, they call out to God. But once God brings about a solution and a resolution and things are better in their lives, they don't cry out to God anymore. They don't call out to God anymore. Will they always call out to God? Job says, and he knows the answer to that question is no. That's a hypocritical faith. It falls in the category of wicked, unrighteous hypocrite. So the hypocrite has no hope for their soul with God. The hypocrite has a disconnect from God. And then Job in verse 11 says this, I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? I love that he challenges his friends in that way. Like, you guys are talking nonsense. And so he says to them in verse 11, let me teach you. I can teach you about the hand of God, and what is with the Almighty I will not conceal. In other words, when he says, I can teach you about the hand of God, he's talking about the power of God. When he says, I can teach you what's with the Almighty, he's not talking about the power of God, he's talking about the plan of God. So think about that for a second. With everything he's going through, physically, his life has completely fallen apart. He's covered head to toe in sores. I mean, we could just go on and on and on and on and on. Job sees his argument, his debate with his friends, who are wicked, unrighteous hypocrites, as an opportunity to teach them about the things of God. That blows my mind. Because I've never been in as much pain as what Job is in, I'm pretty certain. But I can be in way less pain, and I don't think about other people when I'm in pain. I don't think about, I mean, no offense, but you guys don't cross my mind when I'm in pain. Only I cross my mind. I only think about me. I only think about my pain and what's wrong and what's happening and all of those things. I hardly ever say to myself, I am in so much pain right now. This is such a teachable moment for me to talk about God. But that's what Job is doing. And shame on me, really, for not seeing that the things that we're going through is an opportunity to tell others about what God is up to. It isn't just Job is like, I guess I should be doing this. It's like Job is taking it on as a responsibility. He's going to share, he wants to share with his friends his God story when his life is falling apart. When he's struggling in his own relationship with God, he still has this desire to tell other people his God story. So we can have people diagnosed with cancer and still be able to talk about how God is at work. We can have people lose their jobs and people have their marriages fall on hard times and still be able to talk about what God is up to in that and through that. But do we take the opportunity? I'm not sure that we do. In fact, I want to just read this one verse to you just so we understand that this is not just like a New Testament thing. This was real for Job. And in Psalm 96, verse 3, it says this, "Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all peoples." That's Old Testament. In the New Testament, it gets a label called the Great Commission. It's at the end of Matthew, it's at the end of Mark, it's at the end of Luke, and it's at the end of John. Now that in itself is unusual, because usually the things that are Matthew, Mark, and Luke are only in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They're called the synoptic gospels. They're synonymous with each other in a lot of ways. But the Great Commission is so important that it shows up in all four gospels. Not all worded exactly the same way, but it's there. And the Great Commission is that for Jesus' followers to go into all the world, teaching, making disciples, baptizing, I'm kind of combining all of them into one. And it's an order. It's a command. It's an expectation that God has for those whose lives have been changed by God, that they would go share their God story no matter what is going on in their life. It doesn't say go if you feel like it. It doesn't say go when things are going well. It just says to go. But what's happened in many churches, and I'll include ours in that too often, is that the Great Commission has lost a letter. It's lost the letter C. And instead of being the Great Commission, it's now the Great Omission. Simply because we're not doing it. We've omitted that part from our lives. Well, the church needs to have an evangelism program. That's not what it says. When Jesus said that to them, there was no church. We follow that? Acts had not happened yet. There was no church. He's not talking about the church collective. He's talking to individuals. Now those guys, those 12, got it. Well, we lose Judas, right? But then we pick up Matthias. Is it Matthias we pick up, right? And it says in the book of Acts that those 12 guys who were the closest to Jesus wound up turning their world upside down. Not because of the church, but because of them being obedient to the Lord. Do churches need evangelism programs? I'm not against them. Not necessarily for them. Because sometimes we attribute it to, well, that's something the church should be doing. But Jesus didn't say it to the church. He expects us, in our everyday dealings, whether we're going to school or picking up extra shifts at work like Sonny was talking about, or talking to our brother on the phone like Zenta was talking about, or sitting on the bus next to a stranger like George was talking about, or whatever the case may be, wherever we go, that is our mission, and it's our commission from the Lord to tell them our God story. Well, I'm going through a really hard time right now. So was Job. And yet he saw it as an opportunity to tell other people about the power and the plan of God, even when it wasn't clear for his own life. And I like that about him. Back to Job 27, verse 13. Job clues us in here on a few more things in this section that are talking about the life of the wicked. First, he gives us another synonym here. It's in verse 13. This is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. So we have a fourth synonym Job is using. He began with wicked, then he gave us unrighteous, he gave us hypocrite, now he gives us oppressor. And an oppressor is simply somebody who has power and they know how to use it in a negative way to keep other people at bay or not to give other people what they should be getting. So somebody who wields their power as a billy club or something like that. Okay, follow that? So it's somebody who uses their power incorrectly to keep others down. So here's what he says about the wicked, unrighteous, hypocrite, oppressor. Here's what their life looks like. Verse 14, if his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive him shall be buried in death.
So we see a couple things right there. The wicked person is setting the tone by the way they live their life for the rest of their family. The righteous person is setting the tone by the way they live their life for the rest of their family. Both have the opportunity, wicked and righteous, to set the tone for the rest of their family. All the wicked person is doing is setting the sword upon their own family. It's another way of saying difficult times. So the families of wicked people go through difficult times. The families of wicked people, the other thing he mentions there in verse 13, are simply not satisfied. Can you, sometimes Elisa and I talk about this even at our house. Can you believe how few toys you had as a child? Right? I mean, you look at the kids who are growing up today, the kids who are out at Splash Mountain VBS this morning. You look at the amount of toys that they have. I mean, what did you have, really? Right? Like a little wooden truck and a Raggedy Ann and Andy doll or something, you know? We just had way, way less growing up. And you know what? I think that we were more satisfied than the kids today. The kids today, and I have four kids, okay? So the kids today have everything that they have, and they're still not satisfied. They still need the next new thing that comes out, or whatever the case may be. Listen, if you want stuffed animals, my wife is up in New Hampshire. So if you want some stuffed animals, come to my house after church. I'll give you some stuffed animals, just to get them out of the house, you know? Or board games, or the coolest new electronic toy, or whatever the case may be. And listen, Job says one of the signs of a life that plays out, of how life plays out in the life of a wicked person, is that their families go through life not satisfied. One of the things that I learned early on in the ministry from another pastor, actually, had to do, I was early on in the ministry, but we were also early on in having kids. And one of the things that we learned is that they taught us about parenting was that kids aren't necessarily looking for a lot of your time. They're just looking for quality time. And so this guy actually told us, and it worked, is, listen, when your kid is pulling at your leg and, Daddy, can you do this? And can you come outside and throw the ball? Or can you do this? Can you do that? To stop whatever you're doing, get down on the floor with them, or get at eye level with them. Go do what they want you to do, and you put a time limit on them. You don't tell them that. I'm only doing this with you for 15 minutes, you little creep. No, don't do that with your children, okay? But I'm going to go do this, and I know it's going to be for 15 minutes. And for that 15 minutes, they have your undivided focus and attention. You know what? At 15 minutes, they'll be satisfied. They don't want 2 hours from you. They just want two unfocused minutes sometimes. And sometimes the life of the wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical person is so wrapped up in having to keep all of that stuff going that they don't even think they can spare 2 minutes. And how much easier is it now, right, with one of these close by us and in our hands, you know? Anyway, I won't go off on that because mine is right here in front of me right now, so... So that's what's going on. Kids who are not satisfied, kids who are going through their own difficulties because of the way that their parents are living their lives. Verse 15 says, those who survive him shall be buried in death. Second half of verse 15 now, their widows shall not weep. I mean, this wicked person is such a wicked person that when he dies, his wife doesn't shed a tear. Imagine that. She's unmoved because she knows she hasn't really been the love of her husband's life. He knows he hasn't really been the love of his wife's life. Her husband's work has been the love of his life. Her husband's bank account, or the things that he can buy, or the vacations he can bring them on. Listen, our wives, men, would rather have us be home and showing them affection and attention
than whisking them away to Aruba. As good as Aruba sounds, right? Am I right, ladies? That they would rather have us than be going somewhere with us where we're there, but we're not really there, and where it's about the money and everything like that. With the best vacations that we've been on are vacations where, what do they call them now? They call them staycations, because we don't have money to go anywhere. So we're just going to stay home, but we're going to do things together. It might be just to go down for a bike ride on the canal. The first time I did that, by the way, nobody told me that how windy it was down there. And it was awesome the first half of the ride because the wind was at my back. I was flying, my hair was blowing in the breeze, all of those things. I had to come back into the wind. This, somebody here should have told me of this. Never. But you understand. But our wives would rather have that than to be whisked all over the place. And they would rather know that we love them in a different way rather than, I love you. I brought you to Disney World, you know? Well, yeah, but you also stuck me with the four kids the whole time we were down there. Thanks, honey, you know? Or whatever the case may be. Here this guy dies, and because of the way he's lived his wife, his widow doesn't even shed a tear. Verse 7 or 16 says, though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes. Job here is just talking about everything that the wicked person, the hypocrite, the unrighteous person, all that stuff that they gain the whole world, and not a single bit of it can they bring with them when they die. None of it. All those clothes in your closet at home, if you die, someone else is going to wear them. All the money in our bank accounts, all those things we buy, it's going to go to somebody else. It may go to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts if you don't line up things. But it's definitely going to someone else. And so you can, one way to do it is just to go through life and just accumulate all of those things, none of which will go with you where you're going, no matter where you go. And if you're a wicked, unrighteous hypocrite, well, where you're going isn't going to be a good place. We'll get to talk about that in a few minutes. So the wicked set their kids up for a tough life. Their kids are not satisfied. Their kids experience the cutting edge of the sword, difficulties. The wicked don't even have their spouses to mourn for them because they've been more interested in gaining things than in paying attention to the ones they love. The wicked aren't going to bring anything with them. And then in verse 19, it says, the rich man will lie down, but not be getting up. He opens his eyes, and he's no more. Doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are. Death comes like that. Doesn't matter how much of the world you may have gained, or how little you've gained. Death comes like that. And so the rich man will be there one moment, and will be gone the next. Which would make this a logical place for the chapter to end. It would make sense if verse 19 was the last verse. The rich man will lie down but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes and he is no more. The end. It's the end of this wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical rich man, and yet the chapter doesn't end. I mean, what can possibly be there after he's no more? Well, look what Job says. Terrors overtake him like a flood. This is after he is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. After he is no more, a tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. Hey, what's left for the wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical person when he is no more? Terror and tempest. Whether it's Jesus talking about it in the Gospels, or the more vivid picture we directly receive of it in the book of Revelation, death apart from God is a scary thing. Death apart from God is a terror. No matter how you slice it, no matter how you describe it. If you want to describe death apart from God, then I'm talking about hell, just in case you didn't know. If you want to describe hell as a place where there's just blackness, the Bible backs that up. If you want to describe hell as a place where there is an eternal fire burning, the Bible backs that up. Now, I don't know about you, but a place of eternal blackness, that would cause terror for me. A place where there's just a fire constantly burning, but nothing is consumed, that would cause terror for me. But when you combine the two, that somehow hell is both things, a place where there's a fire burning and fire produces light, and yet it's a place of eternal blackness. I don't even know how those two fit together, but I will tell you this. That scares me even more. That's a terror-filled place, reserved for the wicked, unrighteous hypocrite, who even when they're no more, have storms blowing against them, and terror happening. And listen, hell isn't a place, how do I want to put this? Hell isn't a place where you're going to be hanging out, shooting pool with your buddies, having a few beers. It's not that at all. There's going to be other people there, but they're in the same exact situation as you, which makes the last verse of chapter 27 in some ways almost comical, because it says there, men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. It's like somebody who's drunk making fun of somebody else because they're drunk. Do you understand? Like a drunk making fun of another drunk. Oh man, you are so wasted right now. And they're wasted. How silly and stupid is that? How crazy it is to think that hell is a place where there's this eternal darkness and yet there's this fire. Jesus consistently talks about the weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Revelation talks about all kinds of different stuff. You can check it out for yourself. It should terrorize us. And it is a place. And on top of all that, we're not alone there. There's other people there too. And yet everybody seems to be carrying themselves like, oh, you know, you're here and get away from me. And no, you're here too. You're in the same boat. Every person who's wicked, every person who's unrighteous, every person who's a hypocrite, when they are gone, will experience being swept away by a storm, an unrelenting, powerful storm, that your reaction will be, I want to run away from this, but it's just not going to work. It says in Revelation 5, I think it is, but it might be chapter 4, that when the wrath of God begins to be poured out on the earth, the kings and the counselors and all these different people will run and hide themselves in the rocks and in caves and call for the rocks to fall down on them and crush them, because that would be better than experiencing the wrath of God. Listen, I can't tell you for certain what hell is exactly going to be like. I can only tell you what Scripture says about it. And it's a place of eternity apart from God. That should terrorize us enough, no matter what other description the Bible comes up with. Job is bringing all of these things to his friends' attention in the hopes that they will see that they themselves are acting like wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical oppressors. But God recorded it for us so that we could examine our own lives to make sure that we are not being wicked, unrighteous, hypocritical oppressors. And how does it begin? Well, begins how we began. It begins with a lie. Just one little lie. And that's what we have to be careful of, guys. If we're living a lying life, that started somewhere else earlier. If we're tempted to tell the little lie because it'll get you ahead just a little bit more, or get them to be quiet just a little bit quicker, don't do it. It starts you down this path that Job 27 talks about. It will not end well. Now, of course, the opposite end of the spectrum, right? The righteous, not the oppressor, but the person who's helping the poor and so on. And Job spends a lot of time talking about that in other chapters.
The person who's not a hypocrite, the person who is not wicked, hell is not your destination. It doesn't matter what you have done, how often you've done it, how long you've done it for. If you've put your faith and trust in Christ, you are no longer relying on your righteousness for eternity with him. You're relying on his. And that's the key to eternity with the Lord. Let's pray together as we close our service.